Blog Talk Radio.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين. الرحمن الرحيم. مالك يوم الدين. إياك نعبد وإياك نستعين. اهدنا الصراط المستقيم. صراط الذين أنعمت عليهم غير المغضوب عليهم ولا الضالين.
Assalamu alaikum. This is Latifa A. Hameen, the CEO for American Muslim 360, the number one Islamic radio station in the nation, where your intellect is respected and your voice is protected.
The views expressed by the host guests are their own and not necessarily the position of AM 360 or the parent corporation, the Community-Wide Shura Conference, CWSC Incorporated. AM 360 content is intended as a community service and is not designed to provide specific personal, medical, financial, or legal counsel or other professional advice, and no liability shall extend to the host or hostesses of AM 360 or CWSC. We encourage you to seek an advisor for your specific circumstance. Now Joshua fought the battle of Jericho,
and the walls came tumbling down. Community-Wide Shura Conference and American Muslim 360 invite you to promote your organization or event on the number one Islamic radio station in the nation, where your intellect is respected and your voice protected. Affordable rates allow you to promote your event, product, or service and strengthen our national intelligentsia network. Contact corporate underwriting today at info@cwsc.us. That's info@cwsc.us. Or call 910-317-0297. Again, 910-317-0297. Together we can remake the world.
Assalamu alaikum. God, Monday morning.
Wa alaikum assalam. How are you?
Alhamdulillah. Allergies. They got me.
Those are the allergies that are talking?
Yes, ma'am. They got me. You got me again. But you know what? We press on.
Like the fake nails
we sell at the store. Keep going.
You're a press on. You're crazy, Joe. You're a press on nail now, huh? Oh, my goodness. Well, you're in good spirits, we see.
Just hope it don't come off at the wrong time.
Oh, boy, you got to get yourself, what is that, stinging nettle? You got to get some of that to help knock out that allergy attack.
In the middle of trying to make a point and you're shaking that finger, and the nail go flying off. Yes, ma'am. Oh, how are you this morning?
Another opportunity to, we used to say, work out our salvation.
That's right. Yes, it's going to go one way or the other. I'm hoping it go the right way.
For sure.
Oh, yes, ma'am.
So we have hope.
Yes. So we had a lot going on this weekend. I want to start with the good. I was watching the Olympic trials. Did you catch any of them? Especially the track and field.
No, I didn't.
Shakari did her thing. She did her thing. She made it in. You know, Noah Lyles, he showed out. But the one that has everybody talking is this little 16-year-old. 16-year-old young man made it into the men's 100 finals.
Really?
He is lighting up. Quincy, he's from, he had on his high school jersey. So that's what made it, like, fantastic. Quincy, I think it's Wilson. And he broke the under-18 400-meter world record twice in 2 days.
Wow.
42 years of nobody able to break the record, and he breaks it twice in 2 days in trials. Yes, it was amazing watching him. And he's running alongside, you know, 30 and 40-year-old men, 38, I think. And he was just not fazed. And he had to wait to qualify on time. And it was amazing because when the last heat went, they could have run faster. But the leader of that heat, he was winning. And he backed off a little bit. Looked over at the clock, at the jumbotron, and looked over at that young man, winked, and he slowed down a little bit. And it looked like he did it on purpose because he knew what time that young man had to get to make it into the finals. And it's almost like he did it so he could make it into the finals. Because if you make it into the finals, you have a chance to make it onto the relay team. And it was beautiful because that way he could at least, even if they don't use him on the relay, he will get to go to Paris. And I said, now that's beautiful. That was a beautiful thing.
Okay.
And then you got Shakari. Shakari redeemed herself. She broke records. You know, she's doing the Usain Bolt in female form. Which was beautiful too, right? And we hugged her grandmother. And so that was nice. I watched that. I watched the swimmers. You know, my favorite is always track and gymnastics. Gymnastics hasn't started yet. But yeah, it was a good weekend. It was a good weekend. And then I got to I spent the whole week out on travel, and then I came home this weekend to catch a couple of Juneteenth. So I had to spend my Eid on the road. But how did Eid go here? I heard from my children, but I'd like to hear from you. How did it go?
Okay, well, you know, the Eid Salat was in Lowell Park in the downtown West Oakland area. And it was a very good turnout. The members of the various communities. So that was Sunday. And then the following day, Monday, Masjid Al-Arzeen, you know, usually has a big Eid activities day for the children. And when I say children, you know, we see a lot of kid adults who get on those video games and whatnot too. But the children from the little itty bitty ones, you know, up until the 18, 19 year olds.
Right.
And this year, that 47th Ave, right there by the Elijah Muhammad Cultural Center, was blocked off. So they had the jumpers in the backyard, and they had, you know, food service on the side of the cultural center, and people were sitting down and eating. And then towards the end, I don't know where they got them from. There were two of the little motorized carts, like go-kart kind of things that
had those again, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah, they love those.
Yes, and I'm thinking that someone said earlier there was, they had a, because I didn't get there right when it started, they had the a mountain, you know, a wall, you know, a climbing wall kind of thing. So the children seemed to enjoy that. And there was one game that you had to almost make sure your insurance policy was up, because those children were going furious at it, throwing at a board. And some of them, their aim wasn't quite that good, so anyone who was sitting in the vicinity had to be careful. But all in all, I think the children enjoyed themselves. It was a blessing to have such a good turnout. And those days are special for the children, you know. We have some adults in our community now who, as children, grew up with the Eid activities. And they loved it then, and they still love it now. And you see some of them who used to come and enjoy it, now they're brothers on the security or sisters serving the food or in the kitchen. So it was a very beautiful experience, very beautiful experience. And we have to really realize that we are so blessed in this country to have the freedom, to exercise the freedom of celebrating our Eid publicly, you know, and unapologetically, as they say, Muslim. So it was very, very wonderful weekend. Yeah. So I'm sorry that you missed it. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I missed everything. And, you know, it happens. It happens like that, you know, a few times a year. I mean, a few, like, usually, like, every other year or sometimes 2 years in a row where I have to travel during, and this year it happened both Eids. It happened when I'm in, like, D.C. or I'm in Hawaii. I live such a hard life, harsh life.
Yeah, harsh life, right.
Harsh life. Someone has to live. And during Eid, you know, right after Ramadan or right after, you know, Hajj. And speaking of Hajj, did you see what happened? How many people, 1,500 people, I believe they said, during the course of Hajj?
Pray Allah accept their souls into paradise. Yes, that heat, you know, well, I think they said on Arafat it was like 116 degrees, you know, and there's a strategy that you have to use when you make Hajj because of the struggle. You know, the Prophet tradition says that, you know, Hajj is the jihad for the woman because it is is a struggle. I mean, you're in the elements, and depending on the time of year that Hajj occurs, they're in Mecca and Mina and on Arafat. You know, if you're it's the summertime or our summertime, and the heat there is just, it's unbearable. I remember when we were preparing to go, we went in May, so it wasn't as hot as it is this year. And I was worried. You think about base natural things when you're going to make Hajj, right? So I was worried. What about the bathrooms? You know, what if I'm out on Arafat? And, you know, so I was just concerned about that. And I remember one sister said, oh, you don't have to worry about that. You're going to sweat. You're going to sweat. And that is going to come out of you in sweat. So, yeah, every season of Hajj has a different challenge. You know, a couple of years, the force of the crowd with people stampeding. And, you know, there was one year on that bridge going to Stones of Gemara, there was some deaths. And I did see, I think maybe someone posted on Facebook, it was a couple. They were an older couple, probably maybe in their 60s or 70s. And at the last minute, I forgot what country they were from, but at the last minute they were given permission to go. And so they went. And the husband, after he made his initial tawaf, the tawaf meaning that you're circumambulating around the Kaaba, after he made that initial tawaf, he passed away. And so that was a decree for him. You know, Allah called him home and called him to the ultimate home. So we realized these things. I can remember when we were preparing to go to Hajj, Sheikh Abdur-Rauf at Master Warathing, every year he gives a Ramadan class and he also gives a Hajj class. And I can remember two things from the Hajj class that he told us when we were getting ready to go. And this is 30 years ago now. Yeah, 95. Yeah, 29 years ago. And the two things that I remember him saying was, you might as well be patient because this is the way he said, you're going to wait. So you might as well be patient. And the other thing he said, what he talked about, was that after every prayer in the Muharram, meaning the masjid there in Mecca where the Kaaba is, there's going to be a janazah prayer. And he was right on both counts. And the janazah prayer is the funeral prayer. So we know that the tradition is that when the janazah prayer is prayed for them and they're buried, that if there are 40 believers that attend their janazah, that they are assured of the paradise. So can you imagine you have 1 million people at your janazah? So Allah is just and Allah is merciful. We pray for those who are deceased, who transition after making the Hajj or during the Hajj, and for their families too, for their families. But it's a beautiful experience, the life-changing experience. So I see that our brother Fleming looks like he has joined us.
Oh, yeah.
Down in Carolina.
Let's let him please unmute him. And he was
like,
let's see what's making his head sweat. What's making the back of your head itch, bruh? It's Monday morning. What's making you rub your temple? What's making you rub your temple?
Oh, my God. Well, I'm going to start off making dua for the Hajis and return to Allah. I saw a brief news report on MSNBC this morning while I was in Charlotte, North Carolina, there was a family from Maryland, in fact, African-American family, and she was the daughter, and she lost both parents, you know, in Hajj, and she was just saying what they were trying to do to get the bodies back. They didn't understand the idea that many people, as Sister Abdullah was just saying, every time you pray in Mecca, at the Kaaba, after every prayer, there's a janazah service held.
Yeah.
I mean, that's five times a day. So when I was over on Umrah, before COVID-19, you know, became an international issue for us, like Sister Feature and Imam Talib Sharif were the leaders of the congregation I was with, about 33 of us went together. But it just, it's a life-changing experience to begin with. And you have to really pray to Allah to prepare you for going over there. And I will, two things stand out. Of course, the one about the janazah, because you realize how fragile life is.
Yes.
Every time you pray, as soon as you finish praying, someone should turn into Allah. And you see many people there in wheelchairs being escorted, yes, of course, by people who they pay for their service, but they just want to be in the holy precincts when they return to Allah. So their intent is indeed in that vein. They want to be in that area when they return to Allah. So you can actually go to janazah five times a day if you choose to while you're in the holy precincts. But that sort of stayed with me on just the fragility of life. And then the second thing was just to see so many people. Now, this time they say maybe 1.5 million people were there. Some say closer to 2 million. But that huge magnitude of the family of humanity being there, one life is bad to lose. But when you look at the huge number of population, to lose 1,500 people out of that huge crowd, statistically, you know, it's not as big as people projected to be on the TV media, but it's sad in any respect for those families,
right,
who lost their loved ones.
Right.
But the second thing that really made me very sensitive, everybody that I talked to had the same experience. I think I was in Medina this time. Yes, because we left Mecca and went to Medina second. I'm in Medina thinking about my grandfather, and tears just started coming down my face, just the idea of what he did in my life, and I'm just crying like a babe. I said, what in the world is this about, you know? But then all of us go through different experiences when you go through, you know, a nominal requirement of all of us as Muslims at least once in your lifetime. But if you can go, even though I was over there before COVID-19 hit, you know, so a few years back, and I had been on the African continent before, but I'd never been on Umrah at that time, and we had an experience on the airplane when we flew into Egypt. It's somewhat getting on me, made my kufi shake a little bit. But, you know, our orientation is a little different when it comes to this religion. So this older sister, the Egyptian, did not want our imam to sit beside her on the plane. And she actually pushed him in his face and called him something. I speak a little Arabic. Almost like calling him the N-word. And so Sister Feature, so at first, I was about 6 feet behind him, so I stand up. Sister Feature goes over there and says, this is our imam, da-da-da-da-da-da. And the man talking to him and said, brothers, Allah says, prepare us for what we're going to experience once we get there. Because the FOI responded in all of us. He said, no, this is just a test from Allah. Maintain your composure. We're here to please Allah only. You're going to experience people like this. So just accept it as that, you know. But still, when we get off that plane, I walked right behind him with his sister. And some little relative of hers walked up on the imam. And so I had to sort of, in a gentle way, move him out of the way. But you run across so many things that you have to prepare your heart for when you go there, and it's a whole different experience for every soul that goes over there. And we were fortunate, you know, Sister Feature had made, giving us five-star hotels to stay in right across from the Kaaba, right across from the Medina, you know, situation. We had fit food every day. We were given, I think Dar es Salaam organized a trip for us. So we had buses taking us to different locations because it was Umrah. Mm-hmm. So we didn't have to walk, you know, to throw the stones and all of that, but we were a little bit spoiled. But even with that, and I'll conclude with this, when we first landed in Egypt, Imam Talib got a call. Most of you know that he was in the military, in the Air Force, and had a leadership position there. So they called him from the State Department and said, listen, as soon as your Congress landed in Egypt, you will be escorted because there was a threat of Americans. So this brother got on a bus, Egyptian brother, looked like straight from the military, in a coat, of course, but you could see up in his coat what he was carrying, if you were paying attention. So everywhere we went in Egypt, he escorted us, you know. I said, wow, boy, here we are on the other side of this reality here, you know, that you have to be conscious wherever you go and always speak for Alpha to Allah for your safe return back home. Okay, I didn't mean to go out of country that long, but that's it. Had to reflect and pray to Allah, receive those souls who, in the effort to please Him, return back to Him while they were on Hajj. I was encouraged. I saw a program with a 17-year-old sister getting her PhD degree. I said, Alhamdulillah.
Yeah,
go ahead, young scholar. so proud of her, you know. I said, wow, boy, 17, I was just going to have to tie my shoes good. But here she is getting her PhD degree. I would say, alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah. And then another young sister got her PhD from Georgia State University in a sphere of science dealing with the environment. I forgot the exact title of it, but she was the first one to get a PhD in that study, African-American anyway. So I said, alhamdulillah, again. You know, so those are very enlightening things. And finally, I just got my granddaughter off on the plane. One is going to college out there in California, Loyola. It's a Catholic school out there. She's going out there to study how to make films, et cetera. So we spent a little time with her over the weekend and with five other kids. So we got our house back to ourselves. Alhamdulillah for that. But it was nice. So we had three of them up here for the STEM camp at the university here. The one came in from Charlotte and from Raleigh. So we had a house full this week. So we just got back to our house, and we have a moment by the grace of Allah. Serenity. So I hope a lot for that. I thank a lot for this. For the little things in life that makes all the difference in life.
To make us so happy, right?
Yes, yes. So I hope a lot for that. I want to applaud our sister for doing a fantastic job on the program, too, on State al-Islam and MAP 5, interviewing the Vice President, landing with Dr. Cornel West for the presidency of the United States. Sister Amos did a fantastic job with the interview. Very proud of our sister in doing that. Phenomenal job.
Alhamdulillah. All the good was from Allah and all the good was from mine.
Alhamdulillah.
You want to take a moment to give a recap? Let's take a quick break first and then back and do a 5-minute recap.
Okay.
Let's take a... Take a station break first, okay? And then we'll do this.
Oh, ready.
God's peace be upon you. God's love be upon you. God's compassion be upon you. The one soul of humanity. May we let it be in thought and in action. On behalf of CWSC Intelligentsia, the number one Islamic radio station in the nation, where your intellect is respected and your voice protected, American Muslim 360, the Speakers Bureau, the Model Community National Resource Directory, the Volunteer Human Resource Network, Scholarship, the Learning Lab, Ambassadors, National Leadership Advisory Council, Internship, Leadership Development Council, the Think Tank, Strategic Family Institute, the bookstore. May we share completely humanity in spirit and in form, from thought to action. God's peace, God's love, God's compassion. Assalamu alaikum.
Adopt US Kids presents What to Expect When You're Expecting a Teenager. Learning the Lingo.
GOAT, G-O-A-T, acronym. Stands for greatest of all time, as in spaghetti sandwiches for dinner. They're my fave. Dad, you're the GOAT.
You don't have to speak teen to be a perfect parent. Thousands of teens in foster care will love you just the same. Visit AdoptUSKids.org. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Adopt U.S. Kids, and the Ad Council.
Some people call me the girl who was shot by the Taliban, and some... the girl who fought for her rights.
Malala Yousafzai, born in Mingora, Pakistan, raised by parents that were anything but ordinary.
Thank you to my father for not clipping my wings.
As a courageous advocate for the education of girls,
I'm here to stand up for their rights.
Her life was threatened.
The Taliban shot me on the left side of my forehead. They thought that the bullet would silence us, but they failed.
The attempt on her life sparked an international outcry of support. At age 17, she became the youngest ever Nobel Peace Prize laureate.
One child, one teacher, one book, and one pen can change the world.
You say, vote. And someone says, democracy is a sham. Those people don't speak for me. The system is rigged. You say, vote. Someone says, well, it doesn't make a difference. This state is red, that state's blue, this thing's already a lock. You say, vote. Someone says, hey, I'm making a statement by not voting. And then you say, well, I can't hear it. This is not about the White House. This is about your house. If you're not registered to vote, you can't sit on a jury. You can't choose your mayor. You can't choose your city council. You can't even choose your district attorney. You can't decide which measures will help your family and community and which will put them at risk. This government was designed to be changed. You can either make that change or you can take what little they give you. Democracy is not a sham. It's a job. It's our job. And it took too damn long to get it, to just let it slide. You say vote, because there are people who still don't want you to.
Your vote is your voice. Stay silent.
And your opinion is lost.
Your right to vote could be denied.
Changes in state voting laws could affect you.
Protect your right to vote. Call 1-866-MY-VOTE-1. Or visit OccupyTheVote12.org.
It's time to be heard.
Occupy the Vote.
And we are back live. You are online with Map 5, Muslim American Power 5, with Mr. Ahmed Allah, Elijah Zabri, Brother Fleming Elamine, and I am Carol Zanis. And we are discussing our obligations to transform faith into action through proactive civic engagement. Assalamu alaikum. They leave Monday, 24th of June, in the year of our Creator, 2024. What we got this morning, sister, let's start with a rundown of yesterday's show. Tell us what happened yesterday, and then tell us what you got in store for us this morning. Mic is yours.
Okay, thank you. Well, Sister Fitra wanted to do this, feeling a need for more education in the community that is associated with the leadership of Emmanuel Tadi Muhammad and just the broader community. You know, people, like-minded people, people of good conscience, of good faith, good character. And so Dr. Malina Abdullah, she lives down in the Los Angeles area, and she is a professor of Pan-African Studies at Cal State LA. That's the California State Los Angeles campus. And she has been an activist, one of the co-founders of the Black Lives Matter LA Grassroots, I believe is the correct name of it. And so she's been a community organizer and activist in that area, very significant professor there at Cal State LA. And so back in, I believe it was in April, Professor Cornell or Dr. Cornell West, who announced his presidential candidacy several months before that, announced that his vice president would be Dr. Malina Abdullah. So Fitra thought it would be good since she is a sister who is a part of our community, that we let the community have the opportunity to find out more about her and why she chose to accept to be on the ballot with Dr. West. So the first thing that we did was on June 9th, yourself, Cheryl, and Brother Fleming, and Jimmy Salam, Aisha, Mustafa, Umar Hakeem Day, seems like I'm forgetting somebody, but there may have been, maybe Kalim Shabazz, he came on, did a sort of like preparatory program for yesterday, and the title, it was under the Life Topics title, What Matters Most. Sort of a Politics 101, you know, how we should prepare for the November election. And so from that group, I solicited questions that in moderating for Dr. Abdullah that would be broad enough and give her an opportunity to explain the platform. Their party name is Justice for All. In a state like New York, they are write-in candidate, Cornel West and Malina Abdullah. They are on the ballot. And Brother Fleming, you guys are doing a great job down there. I was surprised to find out that North Carolina was one of the first states where they got on the ballot. So each state has different requirements. For an example, out here in California, they need 73,000 signatures for the Cornel West, Malina Abdullah ticket to be an independent party on the ballot. Now, what they're trying to do now is, and this is not just them, but any independent group, when they want their party to attain the level of being recognized as an independent party and to have ballot access, each state has a different requirement. Here in California, they need 73,000 people to register for their party, Justice for All. And if they're able to get 5% of the voting tally, then they would be recognized as a permanent independent party. And so I think that is an important part of what they're trying to do, not just in California. Right now they're on the ballot in 8 states, so they got 42 more to go. They're not in D.C., so make that 43. So they are in Alaska, Colorado, Michigan, North Carolina, Oregon, South Carolina, Utah, and Vermont. And like I said, each state has a different requirement. I think in one state they just needed 500 signatures, you know, so it's determined by that state legislature. So anyway, what happened yesterday was Dr. Abdullah was flying up to Oakland. She had 2 events in Oakland yesterday. And on July 15th, I believe they're going to have a fundraiser out in Walnut Creek. And I just advise everyone to go to CornelWest2024.com. And that is where you'll get the information for if you want to volunteer. They have the what they call their movement, and they're seeing it more as a movement rather than just his running for president. The policy pillars for a movement rooted in truth, justice, and love, that's what they have as their platform on the website, and they just list out areas and maybe a principle or an idea of what their concept is in that particular area. They have economic justice, for example, abolish poverty, abolish homelessness, establish federal public banking institutions to fund public infrastructure and green reconstruction. Then they have worker justice, establish a workers' bill of rights that includes the end of right to work states, greater protections for workers who attempt to unionize. They have an environmental justice platform. We're moving beyond the Green New Deal to a global green reconstruction initiative, constitutional right to clean air, clean water, and a healthy environment, and nationalize the fossil fuel industry. We're talking about reimagining. That's a big one there. Health justice, go beyond the Medicare for all towards true health justice, habeas corpus health care, free health care for any and all residents of the United States, codify abortion rights as a constitutional mandate. Then they have racial justice, reparations to address the unpaid debt to black U.S. residents, directive to complete the reparations process and findings within 2 years so checks can be cut and sent to eligible recipients. Okay, out there, don't start spending those checks yet. This is just their platform, their idea. Then they have, after racial justice, they have transformative justice. Protect free speech, enforce whistleblower protections, and stop the prosecution of those who expose government corruption. Shut down Cop City and plans for similar facilities across the nation. End mass incarceration and the prison industrial complex. She did, Dr. Abdullah did identify her philosophy as that of an abolitionist. Then they have voter justice. Make Election Day a national holiday to increase voter turnout and to foster a transparent and robust voting process. Establish automatic voter registration, same-day registration, and the option to use vote by mail for all eligible voters. We do know that in some cities in some states, you know, voter suppression, they have put all kinds of barriers that prevent people from getting to the polls. Then they have education justice, center public schools and reduce the need for charter schools in the nexus of quality education and tax base. There is no reason why a public school in Beverly Hills should be better than a public school in Lowndes County, Alabama. Free tuition for all state and community colleges. Minimum wage of $80,000 for all U.S. public school teachers, K through 12. That would be a big one. Then they have LGBTQIA plus justice in the unwarranted, unnecessary, and dangerous assaults on transgender people. Gender-affirming standards of care for trans people in public life and institutions. Then they have gun violence justice. In the gun violence epidemic, National Gun Registry database for all civilians, similar to the Resource Conservation and Recovery Act database for hazardous materials. And establish similar requirements for driver licenses to gun ownership. They have immigration justice, massive investment in transforming immigration policy to create a broad legal pathway for residency that centers compassion, morality, dignity, and ethics in crimes against humanity. For migrants and their families, no separation of families, no children in cages. Global justice. Dismantle the U.S. empire. Slash the bloated U.S. military budget. Disband NATO. expeditious and responsible closure of global U.S. military bases, AFRICOM, etc. Global cooperation in lieu of full spectrum dominance. And here's another, these next two are two big ones. Cease all war funding and weapons to Ukraine and invest in peacemaking. Cease military funding to the state of Israel. So those are the main, or those are the areas of their platform, and just a few of the bullet point items that they have listed on their platform. So we had crafted some questions that came from the panel that was assembled on June 9th, as well as Sister Fitcher had a question, and then there was another politically astute individual who had submitted a question to Sister Fitcher. And throughout the questioning of Dr. Abdullah, we intermixed questions from those who were on the Zoom call to Dr. Abdullah. And so I think we had a few little glitches, technical glitches, because she had just flown in and she was at the airport. And so we got all the public service announcements that they make at the airport sometimes as background interference. But all in all, I think that more importantly, I know for me, it gave more insight into their intention in running. A couple of significant points that she made, I thought, was there was a question from the chat that referenced Ralph Nader. You know, for years, Ralph Nader ran as an independent, and I think it was in the year 2000, this question referenced that he won, Nader won 90,000 votes in Florida, but he didn't get a single electoral vote in the 2000 contest, and that his campaign was the depicted or labeled, and his running was categorized as his being a spoiler. And that there are people that believe that the independents that are running now, the fear is that they will siphon off votes from Biden, and so therefore Trump or the Republicans will end up being the winner. Now, she had an answer to that that I think that I'm going to do more research on, but it, I think that it paves the way for people to consider their effort more seriously. And her response was that she's a member of the Black Political Scientists Association, and that she had requested of them, she had also done study, and she had requested of them, she had done research, and she had requested of that association to do research to see if there had been any credible study that came to the conclusion that the efforts or the votes garnered by an independent party siphoned votes away from the Republican or the Democrat. And the association came back with her and said that they had not discovered any credible research that confirms that fact. And then she said that statistically, with the recent national campaigns for the presidency, that to our shame as Americans, really, only 60% of the vote of only 60% of eligible voters actually vote in the selection of the president or the vice president candidates and that this degree of apathy that leaves 40% of eligible voters not voting, that independent parties such as Justice for All, this is where their appeal is, to get those who are disheartened, discouraged, who are not voting, to get them to the polls and get them to vote. And by doing that, they're not taking away from that 60% pool. This is what I was getting from what she said. They're not taking away from that 60% vote. They are, in fact, bringing more voters into the total pool. So I thought that was an interesting comment from her. I will say that she came across as very knowledgeable. Her undergrad degree, I think, was in political science. She came across very sincere. And afterwards, I felt that she gave enough information for people to size up what their campaign is about. And to in answering that NADA question, she said, rather than a spoiler, people should see that the Justice for All party is an investment in looking at the existence of other options besides the duopoly of the Democrat and the Republican. She was saying anybody that you vote for should earn your vote. So take your vote for granted. So I thought that was a good note to end on. And I think that the audience, regardless to who people vote for, I think that if they were open-minded, they at least got a different perspective of what their campaign is about. Because sometimes you can look at and say, why are they doing it? They know they're not going to get any votes. They're in 8 states now. If they, by some miracle, got all of the elector votes from these 8 states that they're in, I think it comes up to like 98 electoral votes. And 98 is a long, long way from 270 that's needed to win the election. So I think her investment in the options that are open to us in the future, and they see this as a movement. So it's not just about the 2024 election. They see it as a movement to, like I said earlier, get people active, taking on their responsibilities to vote. And one word, when you look through their website, one word that they use quite a bit is reimagine. So this idea of reimagining other options to the gun control issue, to the criminal law system, to the the voting process and independent parties. And, you know, so they're trying to, I guess from the professorial focus of them, they're trying to get people to think, and from that thinking to get started in the actions that are needed to start a movement. So they have until July 5th. So I think that yesterday was 12 days, so 11 more days. To get the 73,000 votes that they need to get on the ballot in California, which has the largest number of electoral votes. California has 54, Texas has 40, Florida has 30, New York has 28. He's not on the ballot in New York, but he is a write-in candidate in New York. So, those Californians who want to do that, you go to their website and they walk you through what you have to do in order to get them on the ballot in California and well, all the states. And they have a map there that you can click on to see which states they're already on the ballot and which states that they may be in process, and you can sign up to be a volunteer. So It was an informative program, I think. And I got a couple of comments from folks that thought that she did a good job in, you know, presenting what they stand for. And that's it. We have a hand up, so we might want to go to that. Sister Cheryl, I don't want to keep them waiting too much longer.
Sure. Caller 7426, you are on the air with Map 5. Tell us your name and where you're calling from this morning. Apple Lake 426, you're on the air.
The last four digits, 7426. 706 is the area code. Okay, maybe they stepped away.
Yeah, while we wait
back
for you. Yeah, we'll come back to you.
So, Brother Fleming, you were on the Zoom call. Do you have any comments? I mean, what struck you? Because I would be interested in you and Cheryl and any other political operative that might be in our audience. How did you view her comments, her answers, and whatnot?
Well, two things. Her authenticity and her passion being engaged in the whole political process. That was really paramount to me. And her sincerity, of course, came along with that. And her depth of understanding how political processes work. Well, her intent was indeed to create a movement versus a moment in time. And it reminds me of her work is almost identical. Some of the language. Or some of the nomenclature with the Poor People's Campaign, the Low Wage Workers Movement, that I'm engaged in, used for the same numbers, in fact. And we have so many people who just disconnected from the process. So we have a specific strategy to engage 15 million additional voters in this process because they've not been appealed to, they've not been invited to participate, and so they're discouraged. So we've done a little calculation that we can just get a percentage of these people in each state, and we identify the states. We can change the dynamics of how people are elected for this any process when it comes to electoral politics. So the same sort of format. We have 17 points in our agenda to identify certain things that we're concerned about that have not been addressed by the major parties. The other thing that I was really impressed with is that we always say that we don't endorse candidates. We want candidates that the voting public to be informed of what's really going on, and we should challenge the other one for our vote. Explain why what they have done to earn our vote. And I've gotten a few calls already from people in North Carolina saying, well, Slammer, why don't we bring her here and have the other candidates to come over to Greensboro at the W.D. Muhammad Islamic Center over there and have a forum discussion. And I told a couple of them, they used to be officers for ACTG. I said, if we've sponsored, we have to be nonpartisan. So we can invite all the third-party candidates and some others and have an open invitation and hope that that certain people show up, and we can't limit it to one specific person. So we're discussing that now to see how we can sort of arrange that here in the state. And one final thing, because North Carolina has the greatest number of HBCUs, Dr. Cornell West has made an impression. He's spoken to all those colleges, in fact. And that was a catalyst behind him getting on the ballot so quickly in North Carolina.
That's good. You see, your last statement just shows their strategy and insight to me as far as how they're going about attacking this problem of getting on the ballot, because I think they've encountered, you know, very upfront confrontation from the Democratic Party, you know, this whole idea of siphoning off votes from the Democrats. And I tried to reassure the audience that, you know, both Study Al-Islam and ACGG and like-minded people, which are both 501c3s and sponsors this MAP 5 program, we're not trying to endorse any candidate. We're just providing information for the audience so that they have ideas that have not come filtered through media but come directly from the candidates or representatives of their party directly so that they get a clear message of, okay, what are these people about? What are they standing for? they can always go and look at their history and their background and what have they been involved in. But what is their message? What is their platform for this particular campaign? So I'm glad that you did get some responses. And you should note, too, Brother Fleming, that there were brief spaces of time when your sound was not as clear as it is, I think, when you're right where your phone is. So you might want to take your phone. You're walking around.
All right. Can you hear me better now?
Yeah, you're really good, clear. Uh-huh.
Okay.
And the low-wage worker thing, they have some interesting points that they have on their platform. They have requirement for all nonprofit organizations to allow for the unionization of workers and collective bargaining. 1 year limit on contract negotiations. If the contract is not completed in 1 year, the demands of the workers will be immediately codified. Now, I can speak to this one because when we would negotiate with the University of California, with every single union, they try to make you go at least 2 years because they know by the end of 2 years, people are so disgusted and frustrated, and the one that they take that anger out on is the union. They don't realize this is a willful and, you know, strategic tactic of the employer, because they know year after year, as the cost of living for people increase and their salary is stagnant, that people will be angry. And so they feel that, well, you're not doing your job trying to negotiate for us. Well, if we say go out on strike, then you don't want to go out on strike. So what is it? Are you going to put pressure back on the employer, or do you think that out of the goodness of their heart, the employer is going to give you what they know? You know, they know you deserve it, but, you know, that greed creeps in. And most of the time, the people that you're negotiating with, the representatives of the employer, they're non-unionized management folks, and they don't want you to get more than they get. So it's a very dysfunctional system, and people don't realize that they have to be willing to take collective action to bring pressure to bear on the employer. And then they have here on their worker justice platform, 33% minimum worker representation for all boards of directors. Transfer paid family leave to mandate a minimum of 6 months fully paid time off. End all pay discrepancies based on race, gender, identity, disability status, etc. Establish a federal commission to institute a four-day work week. Review all U.S. trade agreements and cancel any provisions that exploit workers domestically and internationally. Now, that one will be real difficult. National free pre-K child. So that's what they have in there, listed out under their worker justice platform. Very ambitious indeed. Sister Cheryl, I see that we do have a hand that's raised. It looks like from the online system, the 111.
Sure.
Yeah.
Good morning. Yeah. You, assalamu alaikum. You are on map 5. Talk to us.
Assalamu alaikum.
Yes,
Amatullah. I'm Rani.
Milwaukee,
Wisconsin.
Assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum assalam.
Well, first, Sister Amatullah, you summarized the event yesterday very well, and I have a couple of observations.
Mm-hmm.
One was in regard to the campaign season being stretched out for such a long time in the United States and being dominated by parties. I think it puts in the minds of people that those actually are the parties, that this is the procedure that has been established, maybe even in the Constitution, you know, this two-party system, and people just default that is just the way that it is. And even when people have debates or forums, a lot of times it's just the Democratic and the Republican Party that are involved, and other people are just automatically excluded. So at this late time now, well, I don't want to give too much of my personal opinion, but I just want to say that it is it's getting, you know, close to the time to be making some firm decisions now. Yes. And so to add some other things into the mix may be a little bit late, but I do have a great deal of admiration for the effort in general. Now, my I guess one thing that I disagreed just slightly with her on, and that was with the labeling of President Biden as Genocide Joe, not because of his actions, but just because we as Muslims are advised not to give labels or nicknames. And also there could be some labels and nicknames that could be given to, you know, to his chief opponent also. But I think it's just best for us to stay away from that. And then the other thing, by putting focus, and this is not just her, this is just everywhere now, putting so much focus on the presidency, and you've heard me say this before, takes the focus off the Congress, which actually should be doing a lot of these things in terms of passing bills. And the president does have the authority of the executive orders, but the three branches were established for a reason. So personally, I would not want us to continue to put more power into the executive executive orders, but make the Congress do their job and take some of the responsibility and take some of the attention that should be rightfully theirs, because they get a pass to me a lot of times to not do things, or either to pass things, and they don't even let us know. It doesn't even make the news, some of the important bills that they are actually passing. And you go online and, you know, and look, and wow, this passed, oh my goodness, this is up for a hearing, and you just don't even hear about it. So the campaign, again, sucks a lot of the air out of the room for the things that aren't going on, that are affecting our lives, future lives, and present lives. So I guess those are my observations from yesterday. And thank all of you that had anything to do with pulling it together.
Thank you for your insight. Thank you very much. Yes, very important.
Definitely. Yes,
very important.
Yeah.
I sort of had this. Circles, unfortunately. And I thought back to World War II, the name given to President Roosevelt at that time, when this situation was really happening with that tragedy in Europe with the Jewish population. There's a reason why there's no statue per se in Washington, D.C. All the ones that he did served for 4 terms. The only ones that have done that, actually, because it's black and white.
But assuming your sound is going in and out again.
Oh, my God. How is this? I don't take it off speaker. This might be better.
Yeah, because I think when you move, when you walk around.
Okay, yeah. I'm trying to be still here. I was saying that when the sister made the comment about describing President Biden like that, my mind went to the name that we given to President Roosevelt during World War II. When it took a lot of effort to really engage his country into that situation, and had it not been for the Pearl Harbor incident, the response from Congress was very minimum to responding to what was really going on in Europe at that time, in those camps in Germany. So it took that kind of attack on the country's psyche to really get us engaged militarily, even though we were providing, you know, war equipment to Great Britain, et cetera, and doing some armament transfers, et cetera. our direct involvement didn't come about until the attack on Pearl Harbor. So I sort of, you know, cringe at this concept that we should label him like that, even though I understand the sentiment. There is a historical context to that, too. My concern also, when she responded to the question that was raised about Project 2025, I was very impressed with what she said in terms of us having a plan of our own and how that represented, you know, the worst thing that could happen to this idea of democracy if that's implemented, and how there's some states that have already started implementing that, like the state of Louisiana, where now they've actually passed a law that says, by the governor, that says every classroom from kindergarten through university level must have the Ten Commandments somewhere in the classroom posted. And, of course, there are a lot, many lawsuits behind that, but that's all a part of this national effort from the what's been labeled now as the white Christian nationalist movement. It's really well funded, and they're behind the Heritage Funding of Project 2025 as well. So we got to be mindful of those elements as well. And we can't give the Senate a bypass either, because it's the Senate Judicial Committee that makes a recommendation even for Supreme Court justices, and they're there for 6 years. So that the work that they do has a far lower impact sometime of what the country is involved in, even in Congress sometime with the representatives. So we got to look at all three of these bodies, Senate, House of Representatives, and the President, who we deal with impact on the country. Not to even mention Supreme Court. That's a whole different discussion in itself. But I was impressed with the way that she responded to the question about Project 2025. And I just encourage everybody that's listening, take the time to Google out that. Project 2025, and just take your time and read even the executive summary so you know what the thinking is from the Heritage Funded Foundation if they can get control of this country again. And our job is to keep you informed so you can make an informed decision, inshallah. And I'll pause there.
Yes. Yes. Go ahead, Cheryl.
I'm glad she turned on him on. That was one of my things where I had a reaction, only because I, you know, if someone involved in this arena, it's just one of my preferences not to talk about a candidate. That's just my preference. Having thought about it from a religious standpoint, so I'm glad that, thank you, sister, for saying that, because I hadn't even thought about it from that angle. It's just that that's just, I always have a reaction when someone who's campaigning says something about, you know, negative about the other candidate, because that's just, I think it's just the way that I was reared. I want to know about you, and the moment you start going negative about the other one, and this includes the major party, it throws me off, because I don't care. I want to know what you're going to do. I don't want to hear. I don't want to hear the negative about the other person, because it's almost like gaslighting, right? The other thing that I was listening for, that I liked the explanation about the movement and everything like that, but when the question was asked about is this taking away votes, or is this, you know, the viability of the campaign, I was hoping to hear something about the willingness or the ability to take this platform and work with the administration that does come into office or does come into power, because that is where it's going to have the biggest effect or the biggest change, right? Because if you do build a movement, if it's not just about right now, 2026, 2024, if it's about 26 or 28, then how do you affect change for the long run? You affect change for the long run by working with the people who are in power, not just in the presidency, but in the Congress, in the judgeship, in the mayoral offices, in the city councils, in the local offices across the country. And so I was really hoping to hear more on that part, on how do we bring more people, especially young people, into not just young, but more local
local and jurisdictional, regional, municipal leaders into this type of I don't know if I want to say independent, because I don't think it's independent. I don't think anybody's truly independent. But
non-affiliated?
You're not non-affiliated. Yeah, thank you. Unaffiliated type of where you're not weighed down with having to pick a side. Like this what my children were telling me like this last week. And I was at a conference in the Naleo, we call it Naleo, is Latino elected officials. And then also I was with AAPI lead, Asian American Pacific Islander lead, which is also elected as Asian American Pacific Islander elected officials. And so we had this, at the second half of the week, we had a joint conference. And what we were talking about is that, especially with Latino voters, it's a huge, huge. So between Black voters and Latino voters, that's the populace. That's the voting populace.
Mm-hmm.
And the pollsters are saying that the two major parties are just not speaking to the issues that people want to hear. And even with this whole thing about Biden had announced, I think we started meeting on Monday, he had announced about immigration, right? But just so you guys know, immigration was not the top issue that especially younger people want to they care about. It was really going right back to the basics on the economy and housing and my job and where I'm going to get some food to eat, things like that. So going back to those issues. And the last thing I'll say is, Sister Martella, the last thing was, yes, they did speak about, you know, all the minimum wages and raising the wages. And I thought it was very serendipitous because the governor of California, especially when you talk about low wage earners or teachers and healthcare workers, because to meet the budget here in California, they just took off the table the 2-year plan to raise the wages for healthcare workers and some of those. They just stayed that those wages because we have the deficit here. So I guess in my mind it was it's having the plan to make it happen, right? It's not just because all of these are really great ideas. It was a plan to make it happen, especially in other if besides California and New York. What about these other states that are still so far behind on the minimum wage? They still have the federal minimum wages and minimum wage. They're not even close to having, you know, $18, $25 an hour. We just reached $30 an hour down in Santa Clara. And they're nowhere near that across the country. So how do we bring them up to that? Nevertheless, $80,000 for a teacher. I think the ideas are good, but how do we reach execution?
Just if I could, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Go ahead. No, go ahead.
I was going to give a recent example, too, of how strategically we bring these changes about, and the resistance is very intense. We had a group down in Carteret County, North Carolina, yesterday, a part of our Poor People's Campaign. They were actually assaulted, jumped on, and beaten because they went down there to defend some of the Indian rights that we had established as one of our strategic action plans to defend them. And they went down to Carteret County, which is on the coast. That's where Emma Island, Atlantic Beach is at, et cetera. I'm down there quite often. And they were actually beaten by a group of protesters down there. So we're now in the process of getting them some legal, you know, protection, et cetera. And we're going to have a bigger, you know, response when we come back from Washington, D.C. But the resistance was simply based on everyday people having the nerve to put a voice behind an issue that they didn't agree to. Now, some of you may be familiar with this documentary that came out called Silver Dollar Road. That document was based in Carteret County. And in a very brief fashion, there was an African-American family that owned this property for years, going back to the Civil War era, shortly after that. And a developer came in and was able to manipulate one family member to agree to sell a certain part of the land, et cetera, in the heart of all this land that they owned. And they were actually imprisoned in Carteret County for protesting that, the true owners, for 8 years. And so the attorneys who came on board to defend them and get them out of jail, you know, I just happened to know one of them out of Barron, North Carolina. And it was just almost unbelievable, the attitude of the people, to think that they could just come in and imprison the rightful owners of this property. Now, they're out now. They're going through some, you know, other options to solidify future ownership of the land. But it just gives you one small example of how every city is different, every county is different, and it's a lot of work we still got to do just to be recognized as having the same human rights as other groups. This just happened yesterday, literally, as an example of resistance. And so when you make your plans, you got to make a three-pronged strategic plan to bring us real change about. And you got to touch base, yes, with public outcry, but with the legislative objective, with an executive order objective, and with a judicial objective as well to create, you know, long-term, you know, change. And I think the program we did before we interviewed our sister, this one with Cornell West, we really focused in on local politics and the importance of voting the whole ballot. Some of the issues you raised, Sister Cheryl, that are very, very prevalent as we go forward in our discussion on politics in general. But there's a lot of resistance. I'll end with this. I'm sorry for being on a soapbox so long, but we had the adoption of the campaign Take Five by the North Carolina, it's called Democracy North Carolina Group. There's 24 chapters in North Carolina. They put together a form. On the front of it, it talks about Campaign Five. On the back of it, they have space for five people for you to register and information to the right to make it very simple for people to use this as one method of bringing more people on the ballots. And they're putting money behind the campaign. And I hate to say it, but it's true. They put more money behind it than some of our people who should see the need immediately. And I'll just end with that. So it's a lot of resistance out there. So that's even one reason, brothers and sisters, we've got to work together and build stronger coalitions with each other. I think Brother Umar made a very strong presentation on the program this past Sunday on how important that is for the work he's doing in California. It was sad that he said he had 600 leaders in one effort he put together. Not a 600 leaders, only three were Muslims, which is really a sad commentary on our level of engagement, unfortunately, in 2024. And I apologize if I went too long-winded on that, but it was on my heart. I had to say at least 80% of that. Forgive your brother.
Don't ask permission, just say forgiveness. We know that one.
Oh, yes, yeah, that is a strategy we all have used, I'm sure.
All right. Thank you for, you know, we appreciate all the effort. I mean, you're a one-man political machine down there, one Muslim political machine down there in North Carolina. I just had a couple of points. First, I want to thank Emma Talal and your comment. I have used the term genocide Joe on this program, so I apologize for that. So thank you for reminding me of our tradition of not engaging in those nicknames. I'll just have to say Joseph Robinette Biden, the president, current president of the United States, who has been accused of criminal crimes against humanity. But anyhow, going on, answering Cheryl's, and Fleming and Cheryl, please call me to task anytime that I use that that nickname for the current president. But
yes, ma'am.
Cheryl, your question as far as the how, I don't think that the program was designed to deal with the how. It was more designed to deal with what are you proposing. The how,
sure.
I think, is something that you have to do
in their power,
that's the in-house kind of thing. But also,
right.
Aisha said, you don't want to show all your hands. But from the way that she answered questions, I don't have a doubt that they thought about the how and that they're working on the how. And the point as far as the willingness to work with the whoever wins, I don't think this is a time for that also. I went back and I looked at the film Shirley on Netflix, which talked about the presidential campaign of Shirley Chisholm.
Shirley Chisholm.
And, and so even though it's fiction, you know, I have to commend Regina King and her sister Raina King. It was an excellent quality film, and I would encourage people to get a look at it because it just gives you, it's a glamorized, you know, Hollywood look at the political arena. But I think there were some nuggets in there that can appeal to just the general public. And the point that I wanted to make that related to your point of not hearing a willingness to work with the other parties, Shirley Chisholm from the film, Barbara Lee appeared. I did a little brief thing at the end because she worked on that campaign with Shirley Chisholm. I think that if there was a need for a correction, I think that she would have spoken up about that. So I'm kind of relying on the authenticity of this idea that came across to me on this fact that, of course, from the outset when she announced she was going to run for president, you know, she was mocked and scorned and everything else that was to be expected. The people in her campaign tried to get her to go to Gary, Indiana, because, you know, African Americans were holding a convention, and you know, in the spirit of developing third party candidates and this, that, and the other, and she resisted going. And when they finally pegged her down to why won't you go to Indiana, she was saying those people don't have a single woman who was a speaker on that program except for she named somebody who is introducing a man, right? So on that principle, she wasn't going. But then when it was getting down to, and she was very adamant about not going to California to put in a lot of resources to California, because she was saying California is a winner-take-all state, and we put all our resources there, and we don't end up with nothing. So that was an interesting point, too. And then towards the end of the movie, they show a point. Now, Ron Dellums, who was a congressperson from California, Oakland, and he, after he left the Congress, he became the mayor of Oakland. Two California politicians they talked about, three, Ron Dellums, Willie Brown, and Barbara Lee. Okay, and so Ron Dellums initially encouraged her, and I'll support you. And up until the convention, they showed him in the movie as the one that really turned his back on her. And it was at the point where she had enough delegate votes to really force McGovern to have to, he would not win on the first ballot at the convention, the Democratic convention. And so up until that point, she never conceded with them because, this is me thinking now and analyzing what she was doing, because she had to work from a point of strength. And she didn't become strong until she had, it was Dellum, about two or three people in different states that they were going to throw their delegate ballots to her, and she, I think 250 was the number she came up with. But when Dellum's double crosser, I mean, that's the best word that I could say that was portrayed in the film, but she said that she forgave him because she could, she was telling her campaign workers, you have to imagine the tremendous pressure that he was put under. And then later on in the film, they said, you know, that until he left and she left, you know, they were friends and they worked together. So to me, that part showed what you're talking about as far as a willingness to work with the other side, both on Dellum's part and on her part, where I think she had proved what she needed to prove as far as a people's movement could be like the little, what is that thing, the little train that would, or the little ship that would, whatever, some kind of little children's thing. But she proved that the people power.
Yeah, the little engine that could.
The little engine
that
could, yes.
The little engine that could.
The little engine that could. Yeah. She kind of proved, her campaign proved that as far as within that Democratic Party, that she could garner the forces that would challenge and keep the dominant forces in the party from being able to just win outright on the first ballot. So I think that at this point, it would be suicide for West or any third party candidate to say, well, I'm willing to work with, you know, the Democrats or the Republicans, whoever wins, we're willing to work with them, because they've ignored you to this point. They're not going to pay attention and be willing to work with you until they see how much strength that you have. That's just the way that they operate. Otherwise, there would be no need for you to come up as a third party. So that didn't surprise me that she wouldn't say, you know, of course we're willing for these things that we want to work with whoever wins, you know. Whoever wins is not going to pay attention to them unless they see, you got 5 million votes, I better listen to these people, because the next time they may get 10 million or 15 million or 20, you know. So I think that's just the way that works. But, you know, you two would know better because you actually work within that machinery in your public offices. So that's it.
Yeah, I think during a primary election, when you're trying to qualify to get into the general election, often that question comes up. If you lose the primary, are you willing to work with whichever party wins the primary going into the general election? And that's a pretty standard question, you know, across the political arena, to see if you want to really work, you know, beyond just the primary election. That in itself has merit. But when I saw the film, Shirley, you know, my mind went right back to President Obama's campaign, because she had a lot of Dowden Thomases when she first announced. She's only been in Congress one term. So she's coming from the congressional side. President Obama came from the Senate side. He'd only served one term, and he was going to run for president. Right. I remember the campaign very well, because I was chair of the South Carolina Democratic Party, and I just finished reading one of his books on his father, the searching for his father. And there were a lot of Dowden Thomases. I mean, some of these people came on board real late. They say, the first response was, he'll never win. Who does he think he is? Right. You know, we never had a black president before, And they right. you know, I was a little younger then. And I used to wear his hat. And so some of these so-called seasoned Democrats, they said, Brother Fleming, you cannot wear that hat at a Democratic headquarters down here. I said, well, take it off then. I'm a little, you know, I have that in me, you know, so I apologize. But you're not going to tell me what I can and cannot do, though. It's just not settled in my spirit. But they said, well, you're supposed to represent the whole party. I said, well, I have chosen already who I plan to represent. I'm not telling you to do it, but I'm going to represent and do what I can. And I made I write articles, editorials quite often in the journal, newspaper, and I made a reference to some of these Democrats being Dixiecrats, because I grew up here, right? The biggest hotel in Winston-Salem was called the Robert E. Lee Hotel. Let me say that again, Robert E. Lee Hotel, downtown in Winston-Salem. Now, it's torn down now. They have a nice convention center down there now. There's the Marriott Hotel down there now. But growing up as a child in this community, when you went downtown, the biggest structure you saw was the Robert E. Lee Hotel. And so I called them out. I said, listen, I am your chairman, but I have seen the mindset of many Dixiecrats still, oh, they get hot with me, you know. How can you call us? I said, because I see that in your behavior. I'm not saying anything that I don't see. And if you don't like my position, please. This is a volunteer position. I have plenty of other things I can do. But they voted me in again to be the chairman anyway. But I want to make a comment about what our sister Sister Imrani, about the Constitution. You know, I taught the Constitution for a long time in civics. It's only a four-page document. Nowhere in the Constitution is going to identify of any party affiliation. In fact, President Washington, in his farewell address, warned the country not to become party affiliated because he felt, indeed, that would destroy the unity of the party. And during that time, you had the Federalists and the Anti-Federalists, et cetera, but there was no party, political, organized structure as we have today. And he very vehemently warned against doing that because he knew then that if you went down that line, you're going to divide the country up. And the country at that time was very, very, you know, like a baby nation. In fact, he got the majority of the electoral votes. I think it was 6-9 because the country was so small. He's the only president to get all the electoral votes since they set up an institution. That's got to be challenged eventually anyway because it's supposed to be predicated on the popular vote. But the way each state is organized, the states determine who gets those electoral votes. So if you're smaller today, you go to one of those states that has the greatest percentage of electoral votes because they can impact your chance of becoming president. And you got little states like South Dakota, North Dakota, I have to include Iowa too. Those little small states that don't have maybe one electoral or maybe two maximum, because if they have at least a senator, they should have at least two. That's two. And then they may have one representative or two if it's a small population. They may just have four electoral votes for the whole state.
Yeah,
so you see very little appeal. I'm sorry.
Yeah. No, I was going to say, I think three is the lowest number.
Three is the lowest one. Okay. So they have just a few. They don't have, well, I wouldn't say that. They have very few people in the state. You just have three like that. Everybody gets two because every state has two senators. But beyond that, it's all based on population. So there's nothing in the Constitution that codifies party affiliation. That came long, long down the line. And the president who really got that organized, unfortunately, was Thomas Jefferson. And I won't go into the history behind him and his adversaries at the time, but he sort of got that established. And then after that, of course, it went into what we call today the Democrats and Republicans. But those first Democrats were not friends of us at all. And I end there. Okay, I'm sorry. That's political party, a little brief history. We'll go over other needed conversation that we need to have.
Yes. Sister Cheryl, did you have any comment? If not, I have a couple of vocal things and a couple of announcements I'd like to share. Sister Cheryl?
No, I'm here. Not really. I think the only thing I'll say is that what I mean by, I don't mean that, you know, they have to put their hand or anything like that. It's just that typically when you talk about your platform, you don't like talk about it on these kind of forums, but you do send people to your website, right? You'll mention something and you'll say, if you want additional information, it's on my website. And when I'm talking about, you know, working with an administration, because it was clear to me that this was, especially when you're talking about this is a movement, this is not just for 24, this is for, you know, 26, 28. And what I took that to mean is, and it may just be me reading it wrong, is that when you're building a movement like this, and especially when you hear from an audience who's asking you questions like, okay, so you're not playing spoiler, or if you're not on the ballot in all of these states, the chances of getting enough electoral votes to be able to actually win this thing outright, what is your plan to work with the administration? And going back to Sister Lani's point and my point earlier is that I'm really talking about it's the long game of affecting local politics, of affecting statewide politics, getting people in as the Secretary of State who is affecting how people vote and judgeships and mayors and city councils and people in the state legislature and getting people to run for Congress so that we're not letting people off the hook because we're so stuck on the presidency. That's what I'm talking about. And how are we putting into place a strategic plan to affect that? And that is what I'm talking about. And then on top of that, how are you fixing yours to work with an administration that comes into power to make sure that whatever ideas you have that people have signed on to can be put into fruition? As somebody who's run for office 8-9 times, I'm now on the positive side. I've got 5 out of 9, I think. I was on the negative side for a little while, by the baseball score. I can tell you that most people don't think about if I don't win. I've been conditioned to think that somebody's got to win and somebody will not win. And so I'm one of those people that says it speaks more about you when you – everybody wants to win because losing sucks. It does. And brother, you can back me up on this. But the the public knows your character by what happens when you do not win. It speaks a lot about you and your ability to keep working for community, both when you win and when you do not. And so that was my query. My query was, how do you keep affecting change and keep making things move? Stacey Abrams is a great example, right? When you didn't that woman pushed through something that no one else has been able to do. And that Georgia project affected so much change. And she got so, she said, you know what, I'm going to do this another way. There's another way to get this done. That's what I'm talking about. So what is the plan? If plan A don't work, then what's the plan? I know people hate plan B, but I'm the scientist. And I got one of them personalities where I'm like, okay, you know what? If I can't beat them, I'm going to figure out how to get in there and convince them that some of my ideas need to be enacted anyway. And you guys, both of you know that I spent a lot of time in D.C. And the man who beat me for Congress calls on me a lot to give him ideas and to work through. So I spent a lot of time trying to make sure that what we need for our community, it's enacted. So that's what I'm talking about, sister. I'm complete.
Yes.
That's normal.
It's a relationship. It's a relationship matter. You got to maintain working relationships with people. And even though I think the sister was trying to just explain what they represented in her interview this time, I think she was thinking in terms of these upcoming election and making sure people understood what was on the platform and making it very clear what they represented and giving people a reason for voting. Why should they vote for them? And that was her focus, I think. But it's very important, Sister Shirley, she was saying that for those of us that have been seasoned, I look for a plan A, a plan B, and a plan C, because it takes all of that to really make an impact on the long-term game. We have a case right here in North Carolina. We have a lieutenant governor who's on, I call him, tweeter to the third power. He looks like us, but he don't think like us at all. And he had the nerve to get on TV recently. Well, they're running the ad quite frequently. And he said, I don't care how this baby got into the womb. It boils down to her not being able to keep her skirt down. That's why the baby's there, and it does not belong to her body anymore. So there will be no abortions in the state of North Carolina if I become governor. I said, you pimp, pimp, pimp. Who do you think you're talking to? But that's the level of, you know, of insanity on the extreme end that this, you know, appeared to be African-American man is promoting here in North Carolina. Extreme, extreme, extreme. And he calls himself, you know, of course, a Twitter supporter. But how do you get around that? You run somebody for lieutenant governor, they can replace him immediately. He's not running for governor. So he will not be in lieutenant governor position. So we have another guy named Josh Stein, who's also running for governor. And to show you how these people can be when they want to stay in power, they just passed a law in North Carolina to allow any kind of money to come in without being transparent to support a campaign. What's the objective? To follow as much money into this idiot called Mark Robinson as they can without being held accountable for it because he's losing in the polls. That was their plan C. They couldn't get him with plan A because he's not very popular, because he's so extreme, and he's running behind. So their guy, their plan was, okay, let's funnel as many men as we can in this North Carolina contest. In fact, the projections are this would be one of the most expensive campaigns in the history between Josh Stein and, of course, Mark Robinson. That is to be determined, but that's the projection right now. But, again, we have to have more than just one way. You know, there should be at least, as we've all been taught, you know, many different routes to get into your house, not just through the front door. I'm simplifying it, but you know what I mean.
Yeah.
All right.
So, you know, you're talking about the dollars that they are flooding into the Carolina election.
Yes.
And what caught my attention recently was here in Oakland, there's a group called Oakland Rising that has partnerships with several nonprofit organizations in matters that concern, you know, the Oakland community. And in 2020, there was an initiative that was called Democracy Dollars. And it follows a similar program that was successful in Seattle, Washington in 2015, where voters receive vouchers, $25 vouchers. They get four $25 vouchers that they can use to fund candidates of their choice. And so this is a local attempt at campaign finance reform. So it's been in Seattle for the last 9 years. Oakland voters in 2022 approved that initiative. 74% of the voters who voted approved that initiative, but there has been a problem with funding. The Oakland City Council is talking about a deficit. I think it was a $200 million deficit or something. And so they cut positions in some departments. And so in the public ethics department, they need an analyst that would work on this initiative to bring this democracy dollars into effect for 2026. Here's an example of legislation that has been approved by the voters, but the implementation has been shut down because of a budget. Now, the whole problem with the city budget is another issue that nonpartisan community organizations are fighting with the council as far as now how do you bridge this gap in the budget. You know, a lot has been laid on the recovery after COVID. If you go in the city of Oakland, if you walk or you drive through, you see so many storefronts that have been shuttered. So many restaurants have gone out of business. You know, so many small businesses have just, vanished because of the the after effects of the pandemic. So programs that like this, you know, Democracy Dallas takes a back seat in terms of public safety, you know, fire, police, those kind of essential services. So I'll keep an eye on it, and hopefully we can get a representative from Oakland Rising to give us more of an update and to see where they hope to go with getting the city council to go ahead and commit to this salary position so that the program can be implemented for 2026. Now, on the deficit side for Oakland, this is something that has been a longstanding problem, I would say, the last 35 years, and that's with the Oakland Coliseum. So what the current mayor of Oakland is proposing to help to bridge some of the gap with the city deficit is for the city to sell their 50% share of that Oakland Coliseum. City and the Alameda County is the other 50%. So there are private developers who want to get that property where the Oakland Coliseum is. Now, the history behind that Oakland Coliseum is really interesting when you talk about local politics. I think Lionel Wilson, he may have been mayor. I did an internship with the city attorney's office in Oakland. And before that, when I first went to Oakland, so we're going back to maybe 1990, before that, on the public access channel, I would see the city council meetings, and I would see all these brothers get up from West Oakland, and they start shouting, and they start calling council members' names, and they talk about how you're selling out the city and whatnot. And I was thinking to myself, these folks are crazy. I mean, what's all of this? You know, where's all of this animosity coming from? But when I went to work in the city attorney's office, I worked on the side that they call advisory side, and the advisory side gives advice to the various city departments. And one of the city departments at that time was the redevelopment department. And so I had access to see some of the files of various deals that had been made in the city, and I began to understand why these people were so angry, because of these go beyond sweetheart deals that these developers had gotten in Oakland, different properties in Oakland and different business arrangements in Oakland, where one young Caucasian guy who didn't even live in the Oakland community in East Oakland was given millions of dollars and technical assistance from one of the Oakland staff to open a supermarket. And, you know, I knew where the supermarket was and whatnot. I don't think that supermarket was in existence, definitely not 5 years, maybe 2 to 3, but definitely not 5. And next thing you know, it was closed down. The guy, he didn't have to pay back any of those loans. There's another guy who had been given a deal with Choice Property, downtown Oakland property. When I first came to Oakland, my first thought was, this is the strangest downtown I've ever seen in my life in a big city. You know, coming from New York and Chicago, this was like, this is your downtown area? But anyway, this guy had gotten so many deals in the downtown area to own property that I'm sure he still owns, for his estate if he's passed away. And one property, city gave him millions of dollars to renovate a property. He renovated it, and he was supposed to lease it. I think maybe the first year he paid some rent. And then finally they just like sold it to him, or almost gave it to him at a ridiculous price. And then he ended up leasing it back to the city, making money off of the property that the city more or less gave to him. So I'm just saying, all of those kinds of things go on in Oakland, in probably Raleigh-Durham, probably Lansing, Michigan, you know, all over the country, those kinds of things are happening. And unless citizens are really looking closely at what is your city council or whatever your governing local body is, what is your planning commission doing? How are they parceling out this activity? And I'll get back to the Oakland Coliseum. You know, everybody talked about the Oakland Raiders. The guy that owned the Raiders at the time, he literally, I mean, if he were a bank robber, he would have been Al Davis. He would have been on America's Most Wanted list for the money that he got, the county of Alameda and the city of Oakland to give to him for that Coliseum deal, to have those teams, and then leave, and then come back, and then leave again. And citizens would be outraged to know how much money that man did not pay when a professional football team earns billions of dollars. And then the Warriors, when they became world champions, the city was so strapped, and the county, I guess, didn't want to come up with the money to do the renovation. So what? San Francisco say, hey, we build you a brand new arena. The money goes away from the poor little Oakland is the orphan child again. And the Coliseum is right in the heart of an African-American district. And we have to look at those things and be aware of those things. And so now private developers, they see the value in that land, and organizations like this Oakland Rising and Ebase and others, they're fighting for the community to be able to benefit from this land, this public land that is doled out to these slick private developers who don't have the interests of the communities where these stadiums and whatnot exist. And the freeway, you know, they moved out people to put the freeway. So you got the airport right there. You got the freeway right there. You got BART right there. And these acres and acres of land that are private, that are public lands that now private developers are chomping at the bit to get their hands on. But then what happens to the residents of Oakland who have to struggle with a budget deficit? So it's a lot to unpack there, but these are the kind of things that are going on. And hopefully we can engage our audience wherever you live to become involved and to be an active participant of what's going on in your own local community. I must have said something, right, because I see two more hands went up.
you said a lot. You said a lot.
Maybe 904.
Yep. Which one? 904? We got 90 seconds. Let's get them on. Okay. Let's go. All right.
904 7636.
You're on the air. It's
yes. Is my mic open?
Yep.
Your mic is open, please. Your name and where you're from. And very quickly.
Peace and blessing, Michael Hameen. And I want to offer, I'm in Jacksonville, Florida, and I want to offer a minority report, is that we have the habit of looking at our governmental situation in a very narrow focus and almost to the point of religious zealotry. And there's time for us to look around and see how other communities, the Asians, how they operate without a lot of fanfare and protests and so forth. The Amish, even though they have made choices that are not appealing to most of us, they have a system of government and governance that we're not even considering in terms of how we can be more accountable in terms of our governance expression. The habits that we have, you know, it's failing us. Point where there are many blacks this time that don't even want to vote because of their choices. And, this doggone fear of Republicans, the fear of Trump, this Trump fear is ridiculous. To me, in terms of a people that have come through much darker times than the Trump times, and they fear and they've lost trust in God and themselves. And I'll stop there.
Thank you, Brother Hameen. Our time has expired. Sister Cheryl, do you have closing remarks? And Brother Fleming, 7426, we went to you and we didn't get a response, so sorry that we weren't able to get to your comment or your question. Brother Fleming, you got closing remarks?
Yeah, just to reemphasize the need for every listener to really pay attention to your city, county, and planning boards, because that's the heartbeat of most economic development. So attend some of those meetings. At least watch what's happening if it's available on your local TV medium there. But that city, county, planning board receives those requests for development to take place in your locality. So stay on top of that. Stay involved. Stay engaged. And by all means, vote.
Sister Cheryl, I'll say something to the Cheryl, and then you can close us out. We'd like to thank you for your comments and for your support of the program. On June 29th in Los Angeles, there is a recognition of the work of El-Hajj Naeem Shah Sr. at the Southwest College campus on Imperial Highway. It's a free event honoring his years of dedication. If you want more information, call 424-420-1411. That's 424-420-1411. And it's a tribute to a community hero, El-Hajj Naeem Shah Sr. And then next Sunday, June 30th at 8 a.m. Pacific, 11 a.m. Eastern Time, on Study Al-Islam Life Topics, Naeem Shah Jr. will be the presenter. He is the co-founder of the ILM, I-L-M Foundation, and they have a wonderful program called Humanitarian Day. So he will be giving us a full view of the workings of the ILM Foundation in the Los Angeles community. And on June 26th, CARE, if you go to the CARE website, you will find information on registering for a webinar that they're having on June 26th. So that is Wednesday of this week. And it's a webinar and training on preparing for the August recess, engaging members of Congress, protecting Muslim houses of worship and nonprofits, and advocating for Palestinian human rights. So that's Wednesday the 26th. That's at 8:30 p.m. Eastern, 5:30 p.m. Pacific, 6:30 Central. And on the 27th, the following day, mosque leaders are invited to join a virtual CARE media training program on the 27th. That's Thursday at 6:30. And you can contact CARE Maryland Director Zainab Chaudhry at 410-971-6062. 410-971-6062. So two very important trainings coming from our brothers and sisters at CARE. And that's it for me. Thank you all. Sister Cheryl, you want to take us out?
Yes, I don't have very much else to say. Speak only if it improves the silence. So I'm going to take us out with letting you know that we've been speaking a lot of politics, because that's what we do. So next week, I'm going to talk about putting yourself as priority. We invest a lot in everything else, so we need to invest in ourselves
So stay tuned next week. In the meanwhile, stay purposeful, stay prayerful, stay philanthropic, stay politically engaged, and you will find your power. Do something. Not only this good for you, but this good for your community. And when you change what you see also changes. Have a wonderful day. Have a wonderful week. Inshallah. Assalamualaikum. Make it a good one.
Waalaikum assalam.
Same place, same channel. That's a wrap. We out.
A wrap.
Oh.